This programme is brought to you by the monthly partners of Reasons to Believe. For more information, please visit our website at reasons.org/monthly partner.
Welcome to Imago Dei, engaging minds created in the image of God. This is Average Joe Aguirre with theologian and philosopher Kenneth Samples and physicist Dave Rogstad. Have you thought about death lately? Some people would rather avoid the subject, Ken, but not only would you disagree, but this is one of those big questions in life we should wrestle with as we begin a three-part series on what you're calling the problem of sorrow, death, and grief. In fact, you've taught a course on death and dying, Ken.
That's right.
In years past.
Yeah. You know, Joe, for a long time, I thought to be a philosopher, you had to go to graduate school and get a degree and hopefully get a job so you could be a professor at a college or university and you could call yourself a philosopher. But I don't think that way anymore. I think that philosophy is a very gripping discipline because I like to think about it in these terms. Philosophy encourages you to think about the big questions of life. And I think all of us do in one way or another. All of us look at the world and we ask, why is there pain and sorrow and suffering and evil in the world? And as a Christian and as a Christian apologist, I think the greatest challenge to the truth of Christianity is probably the problem of pain, the problem of suffering. And what's interesting, though, is that you know, we all know that we're going to die. It's not if, it's when. And what's interesting...
I plan to live forever. I'm sorry.
Well, I hope you will, but I think you mean that in a secondary sense, unless you're advocating Joel Osteen's Best Life Now philosophy. What I'm proposing here, Joe, is that... we are the only creatures that know we have to die. And we're also the only creatures that try to deceive ourselves and pretend that reality doesn't follow us through life.
Trying to put off the inevitable as much as possible.
Yeah, yeah. And I understand that. In fact, I'm going to tell a little story later about how sometimes thinking about the big questions of life is far too heavy. I think we were just talking, the three of us, before this program. We were talking about sports. I think one of the reasons that sports is so influential and why so many people follow it is diversion. I think we need to divert our attention. And, you know, sometimes it's divert our attention from the humdrum of life or a lot of work. And, you know, we just kind of enjoy it. But I think a lot of times there are things in life that we use to divert our attention away from some of these big, heavy questions. So I have written a series of articles entitled The Big Questions of Life, Death, and Grief. I'm going to take some of that content and talk with our podcast listeners about it.
Okay, well, let's delve right into it.
Well, let me begin by... I don't think I've ever done this on the program. I'm going to read part of a poem. This poem was written by Alan Seeger. His dates are 1888 to 1916. He was an American poet. And in fact, he was a soldier in the First World War, fought at the Battle of the Somme. Now, let me tell you a little something about the Battle of the Somme. You study that battle, you'll never forget it. It was the largest battle in the history of the world in terms of casualties and death. More than 3 million people fought. This is largely between the Brits, the British, the French, and the Germans. 1916, so this is before America entered the Second World War.
First World War.
Excuse me, the First World War. Seeger was a classmate of T.S. Eliot at Harvard. He was part of the French Foreign Legion. He was killed in the Battle of the Somme. Mm. And in fact, 3 million men fought. 1 million men were either killed or wounded in that battle. It went on for like 6 months. So Seeger later became very popular for a poem that he wrote, and it's entitled, I Have a Rendezvous with Death. I have a rendezvous with death. Let me just read the first stanza. He says, I have a rendezvous with death at some disputed barricade when spring comes back with rustling shade and apple blossoms fill the air. I have a rendezvous with death when spring brings back blue days and fair. Well, that poem, I Have a Rendezvous with Death, was the favorite poem of John F. Kennedy. And a lot of people don't realize that President Kennedy had very ill health much of his life. A lot of people didn't know at the time, probably wouldn't have elected him had they known that he had Addison's disease. He had received the last rites of the church 3 times.
Wow.
He's a very sick young man.
During his presidency or before?
Well, before, and then, of course, when he was assassinated, right. Received the last rites. Kennedy thought he would die prematurely. And what I think is interesting in this context is really the 20th century brought death to the forefront in a unique and powerful way. I was reading a biography by Alistair McGrath, the British evangelical scholar, about C.S. Lewis. And he said that when the soldiers went to the front, when they were about to be brought to the front to fight, a lot of times the men would just run off and act, you know, wildly and engage in all kinds of reckless activity because they thought that they were going to die.
Mm.
I've read similar things about World War II, that the men kind of looked at, you know, they're not going to make it through this war. I mean, World War I numbers are incredibly high, but they're dwarfed by the numbers of death in World War II. So the 20th century with, the atomic weapons, the nuclear weapons, brought to people's attention that not only are we going to die individually, but warfare could bring the death, you know, of a lot of people. And what I want to say about this is that I think that we don't think a lot about death. I mean, I one day sampled the scholar team and asked the individuals, how often do you think about death? And I think Dave and Fuzz said, you know, they didn't think about it very often, you know. I think that one of the big questions of life is that we're mortal creatures. The reason Jesus came into the world is not only to suffer and die on a cross to take away our sins, but I think also in the resurrection we see God taking a human nature so that he can confront man's greatest enemy, death. So I want to talk a little bit about death and suffering. I want to place it within the context of the problem of pain and suffering. C.S. Lewis, one of my favorite writers, wrote a book, The Problem of Pain, one of his best-selling books. You know, how do we think about pain and suffering in a world where you have a good and loving God? And I also wanted to develop this kind of philosophically, and how is it that we can honestly confront our own mortality, but also help people who struggle with sorrow and things of that nature?
Good. Ken, if you're going to address this later, then stop me. But some might say, Ken, why do you want to talk about death so much? That is, why such an emphasis? I understand that you're a philosopher and a theologian. Let's leave that for when it's needed. That is, let's live life now and enjoy it and discuss the joys and let's stay high and positive. Why bring up all this now? That's why I have a pastor. I'm going to rely on him when I need him or her.
No, that's a good question. I think it probably is a good place for us to begin. Joe, I think that I think there's a couple answers to your really good question. I think on one hand, death is something that gets our attention. Death is something that speaks to the reality of life. And I, as uncomfortable as the topic of death is, I think it brings us to the question of who am I? Why am I here? What is life all about? And how and when will my mortal life end? In one sense, it is a heavy topic. In a sense, I think all of us would rather follow our sports team or think about all of the positive elements of life. But, you know, life is fragile. It goes by very, very quickly. And the other thing is, Joe, there are a lot of people who suffer in life. And I think by talking about these issues, we get to the very heart of Christianity. Because if God were to make an appearance in the world, I think he would do a number of things. I think God would be someone who would come and heal people and comfort them in their sorrow and their pain and their distress. And all you have to do is open up the Gospels and you see Jesus. His 3-year public ministry, it's just consumed with him touching, healing, caring, reaching out to people. I think that if God were to make an appearance in the world, Joe, he would somehow resolve our fundamental problem, and that is sin. And that's what Christ does on the cross. But, you know, when I walk into a cemetery, I think deeply about my faith because I think at the very core of the Christian message is the life, death, and resurrection of Jesus Christ. Mm-hmm. So I think that these are heavy philosophical topics, but let me also be a critic. Having taught some courses on perspectives on death and dying, which were largely philosophical classes, although we did get into some of the issues of sorrow and grief and tried to help students to kind of understand the phenomenon of death, if you will. Later, I'm gonna quote Elizabeth Kubler-Ross, who's written in that particular field of the stages of death. But let me be a philosophical gadfly, if I might. I think the reason we don't think about death is because we don't want to. And it is this painful reality. And that kind of leads me in. Dave, I think you wanted to say something.
Well, I just wanted to kind of add or emphasize that, you know, death is just one, as almost your title suggests this, death is just kind of the ultimate end, that suffering is really, pain and suffering is the thing that we do have to deal with now. I mean, we don't wait until we die or are near death because there's so much suffering going on in our lives, either brought on by ourselves or by circumstances or betrayal or whatever it may be, sickness, illness, all of these kinds of things. So in a sense, when you're talking about death, you're really talking about all of these aspects of pain and suffering.
It is that broader question of the problem of evil. And I like to include in that not just evil, but pain, suffering, and sorrow that goes on with that. And, you know, as I think about the question, why does God allow so much pain and suffering and evil in the world? Well, my primary answer, and there are different schools of thought about that question, and I think there are lots of provocative and powerful answers. I tend to lean in the direction of the greater good, and I think one of the best things that God brings out of questions like pain and suffering and death is getting our attention and drawing us to himself. Mm-hmm. I think when we realize that we're mortal creatures, that we're fragile, that we're not captains of our own fate, that really, I think, is a powerful way of drawing our attention to God and getting us out of this diversion that, you know, everything is okay. You know, when you're in good health, and you're young, and things are going well, and you got some money in the bank, and, you know, you don't have any family problems per se, it's kind of, you kind of are tempted to think, you know what, I'm in control. And all it takes is one medical test. All it takes is one call from the doctor, and it may not be you. It may be a loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And so in one sense, getting back to the very first point I made, I don't think I ever chose to be a philosopher. I think philosophy chose me. And I think philosophy can be a handmaid, Joe, to Christian theology in the context of saying we live in a world where there is a lot of sorrow and a lot of pain. But the gospel is God's antidote to that, his answer to that. Let me talk a little bit personally, and then I want to move and talk about some other things. Might sound a bit morbid to some people, but I've always been captivated by death. Joe, I grew up like you, a Roman Catholic, and I remember distinctly the first Catholic funeral I ever went to. It was a large church. A friend of my dad had passed away. Lots of people in the church. The casket was moved up toward the altar. First time I'd ever seen a coffin in my life. Dave, in a Catholic liturgy, there's a lot of formalism.
Mm.
And one of the things I'll never forget was, the priest would... He would use, I'm searching my mind for the word here, but there was an aroma that was used.
An incense
at a Catholic funeral. Mm. And the smell just filled. It was almost a pungent smell. It was sweet, but it was kind of gripping. And I thought to myself, what's happening here? What is this all about? And, you know, I was just a small boy at the time, but I was trying to figure out, what does all this mean, and how do I fit into this picture? I then went to the cemetery, which was a very intriguing place. I mean, as I got a little bit older, I would go to a cemetery and read the dates of all these people that had passed away. And, it began to sink into me that I'm a mortal creature. I'm only here on this earth for a very short time. I remember being a young person. One of the fears I had as a young person, because my parents had me relatively late in life. My father was 40 when I was born. His father was 40 when he was born, and I was almost 40 when my son Michael was born. But when I was a young boy, I noticed that my parents were older than my friends' parents. And I remember thinking to myself, what if my parents were to die? I'd be alone. And so I thought about death, and I noticed that it's a fearful thing. It's a difficult thing. People don't want to talk a lot about it. So I kind of began thinking about it and reflecting about it.
You were an early philosopher.
I was a philosopher.
It chose you, yeah.
You don't choose. You think you choose philosophy. All of you Molinists out there, you think that you choose. Let me tell you something now. So I was curious about it. And when I was in college, I got a job at a cemetery. I was going to seminary. Some people would say the seminary was the cemetery, but I was spending time at both.
Right.
And I would do lawn maintenance, a lot of work, and I would also dig graves. I was the shovel man. My boss would use the backhoe, and we would dig graves. And I had to be there at some of the graveside services, and so I got to see dozens of graveside services. And I, of course, a philosopher, I was observing these things very carefully. And I noticed at some of the services, there was nothing but tears, deep sense of grief and sorrow. I also saw families exhibit a lot of anger. It was just interesting to observe these services and, to dig a grave. I also thought that at some stage it might be nice to have a resume as a philosopher.
Oh, right.
One
and
of your jobs, grave digger. You know, I even at one stage put together a little humorous skit. That, of course, tells you something about death. We like to poke fun at it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. We like to we'd like to feel comfortable enough with it that we can laugh at it.
Yeah.
Let me share you.
Coping mechanism. Yeah.
A coping mechanism. I give a talk every once in a while, 10 reasons for leaving my job as a grave digger. One, I was buried in work. Two, I just didn't dig it. Three, it was a grave time of my life. Four, I was over my head. Five, time was passing away. I didn't understand the plot. Six, I mourned that I couldn't find a good resting place at lunch. Seven, I was at a loss as to why I couldn't vault ahead of my coworkers. Eight, the lifeless work environment left me bereaved. Nine, the graveyard shift interfered with my deep sleep. And number 10, it was a dead-end job, so I departed. You know, what's interesting about that is that we like to, there's an expression, whistling through the graveyard. I've always hoped that I could become familiar with death, that I could look it in the eye. Now, I'm speaking metaphorically and figuratively here, right? As a philosopher. I wanted to be able to look it in the eye and maybe think about it enough, reflect about it enough, that I would lose my fear of death. Now, I can't say that I have. I'll say a little bit more about that in a little while. For 5 years, I taught a course at College of the Desert. This is a community college out in the desert of Southern California. And it was the only time I'd ever seen a college offer a course entitled Perspectives on Death and Dying. So I taught it largely as a philosophy class, although I would look at how the different religions looked at death. Mm-hmm. I would talk about the uniqueness of Christ. I was always drawing people's attention to philosophical and apologetic type of issues. I had some students come to Christianity. Mm. I also had two students die who were in the class.
Mm.
One was killed in an automobile crash. Another one was an AIDS patient.
This is wild. I mean,
during the semester
that must have had
of a class,
quite an impact on the.
Yeah, yeah. I remember in particular the young man who was an AIDS patient, and I remember talking with him early in the class, and you know, he shared with me. He said, "I'm taking it to try to cope."
Oh.
Well, it's one thing to be talking to a bunch of, you know, college freshmen at College of the Desert,
mm-hmm.
and you know they're taking it to punch their their social, their humanities degree mm-hmm. requirement or something like that, as opposed to somebody who is facing a life-threatening illness. And we looked at near-death experiences in the class. We talked a lot about. You know, why do people fear death? And of course, the college students, I think a lot of them, you know, this is my philosophy requirement. Mm-hmm. I wouldn't be here otherwise. But on the other hand, there were people that I think kind of began looking at the deeper questions. And I remember our textbook that I first used, it said that there are some people. And now we're going to talk about delusion. We're going to talk about wishful thinking here. But I remember the textbook, and it's up in my office here at RTB. But it said that some people think to themselves that if I don't think about death, if I don't talk about it, Joe, if I don't acknowledge it, it may not happen to me. And I've always thought that, you know, coming to grips with my mortality and looking at the deep issues of life, maybe it would not only help me to overcome my fear of death, but it might help me to live a more authentic life. You know, it's very easy to get caught up in life. It's, you know, I'm a husband and a father, and I work in ministry, and you know, there's a lot going on in my life. I'm trying to get my kids through school. I'm trying to have, you know, a very loving, caring relationship with my wife. Trying to get my books to the editors on time so they don't yell at me. And it's easy to be pulled in all kinds of different directions. And I think philosophy kind of helps you to look at the big questions of life and ask, what am I doing with my life? And so my reflection in looking at these various issues, whether it was my early childhood, and, you know, I think my dad has had a big influence on me. My dad was a World War II soldier. He saw a lot of combat. He realized his own mortality. And I think at one stage, he gave up hope that he would make it through the war. I remember asking him when I was just a young boy, how do you function when the next bullet could strike you in the skull? And he said in his own way, I didn't give a damn. And I interpret that as my dad thought he was going to die. That's what C.S. Lewis mm-hmm. thought. Mm-hmm. Lewis lost a half a dozen friends. He figured, I'm not going to make it through it, so why do I have to worry about it? So my dad would take me to cemeteries. And, of course, I've been to many military cemeteries, both here in California and various places in the country. And I've seen these graves, and it makes me think, maybe I can live a more authentic life, you know, through this kind of thing.
Well, you know, it strikes me, and I think we've talked about this before, where you can understand how people are not thinking about death so much. They're thinking about how do I want to live my life? And in a Western culture, particularly in America, what kind of lifestyle do I want? How do I want to prolong my life? What do I want that's best for my family and me, my future, that kind of thing? And we largely live in cities or suburban areas where we can avoid even seeing death. And we hear about it, but we can largely avoid things like cemeteries and whatnot. Whereas in the past, when you went to church, there was the cemetery right there.
That's
a relative could die in your home.
Yes.
I even had my grandfather die in our home not too long ago. But you don't have that anymore.
Yeah.
Life expectancy not too long ago was, what, guys, you know,
50s,
but now, you know, we live so much longer.
It's almost 80, 70.
Yeah, all of that has really changed. So I could see how a person cannot think about death so much, Ken. I mean, you've taught a course on this.
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think that that's a very important topic, Joe. I think if we think our death is several decades away, out of sight, out of mind.
Yeah.
You know, my life is very different. I remember studying for these lectures I would give on death.
Even
and dying.
Retired people, I'm beginning a new career now.
That's right. Yeah, that's exactly right. If you're born in 1900 and you're a white male, you could expect to live 47 years. That's 1900. Mm. In the Middle Ages, you might live to be 30. Today, if you're a woman, women live longer than men mm-hmm. generally. Maybe you're a Seventh-day Adventist. You live in one of those blue areas, right? The health diet kind of thing. I have a lot of friends who are Adventists. They emphasize a health lifestyle. You might double 47.
Mm-hmm.
But of course, time goes by very quickly. You know, our life goes by. Joe, I knew you before you had any gray hair.
now it's distinguished.
Now you're distinguished. you're a distinguished guy. I would say that one of the things about living in the West and having advanced technology and living in the city life, it is easy to kind of fall into the idea that you're the master of your own destiny, that you're in control. And I can tell you, having had a life-threatening illness will put you on notice that you're not in control. And that is not always a bad thing. It's not always a bad thing to recognize that we are fragile people, that we're needy people, that we need God, we need a Savior, and being in touch with God. I mean, when I was growing up, I had two close friends who died very young. My friend Paul, another Catholic, middle name Joseph. All my Catholic friends, their middle names were Joseph. But he was killed in high school. He was a senior. He and I were seniors. We'd gone to elementary school, middle school. He was Thor. I was Captain America in our middle school, elementary school days. Played basketball with him. I remember he got his license before me, got into an automobile crash. I saw him alive one day. He was gone the next.
Wow.
Another friend lived across the street from me, Scott. Boy, I knew him forever, it seemed. Played ball with him, fought with him, you know, hung out with him. Automobile crash. I saw him alive one day. He was gone the next. I went to the funeral. I grieved with his family. I remember his mother just grabbed a hold of me. And upon reflection, I think seeing me just reminded her of her own son. So it's not a bad thing to think about the problem of pain, suffering, and evil. And, you know, I know there are different ways of trying to respond. And I think Christianity is a very robust faith. I think Christianity has a lot of ammunition to use to respond to criticisms as to the truth of the faith, particularly when it comes to the problem of pain and suffering. But I remember Walter Martin, who died at 60 years old. Now that doesn't seem very old to me. Mm-hmm. I remember thinking, wow, Walter was an old guy. But now that I'm 59, 60 doesn't seem too old to me. But I remember Walter used to say, and I would listen to him when he would say it, that sometimes a person won't look up until they're flat on their back. Well, that's the case. I used to think the only brave people were soldiers and policemen and firemen who risked their life. Then I was in a hospital for almost 6 weeks. And I saw people, Dave, where it took everything they could to just get out of their bed and make it through the day and have medical tests done. And I began to see that, you know, life has a lot of sorrow. It has a lot of pain and a lot of suffering. And we're called to be people who can bring the gospel to bear on a lot of those issues.
Mm-hmm.
Let me touch on a couple more kind of personal elements, and then we can move to a topic of suicide that I want to talk about. I read a powerful article in the Catholic magazine First Things that I want to touch upon. I remember years ago, I was probably new to the Christian faith. I got around to reading another book by C.S. Lewis called A Grief Observed, and it kind of rocked me. Lewis, of course, got married late in life to a woman named Joy, and it was kind of controversial because she was a divorcee, and some of Lewis's friends were not, he kind of married her very quickly, and it was kind of a bit of a controversy. But she contracted cancer and she died. There is a movie out, Shadowlands. I like the movie. One C.S. Lewis scholar I met in England said, it's a great movie. I'm not sure how accurate it all is, but it's a great movie. Lewis, in A Grief Observed, he wrote this. He said, "No one ever told me that grief felt so like fear. I am not afraid, but the sensation is like being afraid. The same fluttering in the stomach, the same restlessness, the yawning, I keep on swallowing." And I'll never forget reading that. And I reflect back on something in my own life. I've shared this before. I had an older brother named Frank. And Frank was kind of a hippie. And unfortunately, he became addicted to narcotics, heroin. And he had some psychological problems, mental health challenges in his life, and then he was incarcerated. And ultimately, my brother ended up taking his life. He was only 27 years old at the time. I was 19. It was before I was a Christian, but the shock of, your brother dying, it's one thing for a friend of your dad to die. when somebody who you've grown up with dies and they die at their own hands, I remember feeling, you know, kind of looking reflectively in, and all I can tell you is I felt a deep sense of loneliness and aloneness. And I remember trying to share that with my mom. My family was not a touchy-feely family. Our family's a little bit standoffish in that sense. But this tragedy, this sorrow brought our family together. And I remember having conversations with my parents of a nature that I had never had before. You know, talking to my dad about death, talking to my mom about how I felt about it. And I just felt this deep sense of aloneness. And, you know, I remember my mother hugging me and trying to comfort me, recognizing that, you know, her other son was feeling this sense of grief. And I never forgot that. And as you guys know, in 2003, I contracted a bacterial infection. And, you know, the doctors first thought maybe I had brain cancer. Fortunately, it was a bacterial infection, and fortunately, there's good medication, and I was cured from it. But I remember early on when the doctors were very pessimistic with me. I mean, I don't think they want to get anybody's hopes up, you know, illegitimately. They tried to be very candid with me and very honest with me. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to die. I'm 45 years old. I've got three young kids. I've got a young wife. And I remember feeling a sense of fear. All that study, all that philosophical reflection, here I'm looking in the eye and I'm afraid.
Didn't do you any good.
See, just you and Fuzz are right. Don't even think about it. Why bother with it? I felt a sense of fear. I felt a sense of angst. And I think largely the deepest sense of angst was leaving, especially my wife and kids. That's what hit me as kind of the unfairness of it all. But, you know, the more I thought about it, the more I thought, you know, with my brother, I felt a loneliness, a sense of grief. With my own health crisis, I felt a fear and an angst. And you know what? They all feel the same. And I began asking myself, when I got better, I reflected back on it, and I thought, is Lewis right? Is there no difference between loneliness and fear? Is there no difference between a sense of angst and grief? Is it all kind of an inner sorrowfulness, an aching of the soul, if you will? I mean, it's amazing how much fear and loneliness feel the same. And I thought to myself, you know what? The gospel is a way of reaching people, because there have been times, not as many as I'd like, but there have been many times, particularly when I was thinking, studying, praying, worshiping, and I have to tell you, particularly about the Trinity. When I think about God as analogous to a family, and that love that the Trinity has comes to me, you know, instead of loneliness and grief, fear and angst, reflecting on the Trinity, worshiping the Trinity, I felt love, I felt joy, I felt hope, I felt peace. Mm-hmm. And I think to myself, you know, I'm sorry, but Joel Osteen preaches a false gospel. Everybody gets sick. Everybody dies. Most people don't have an abundance of wealth and health. Jesus came into the world, and he was a very young man and died. Died maybe the worst way you can die, crucifixion. Rose from the dead. I think that there are ways of helping people who suffer with sorrow. I know what fear is, and I know what angst is, and I know what loneliness and grief feel like. But I also know what love and joy and hope and peace feel like. And I think there are ways that I can't solve people's sickness. I can't take sin and death and sorrow away from the world, but I can reach out to people and I can share with them that, you know, empathy, I think, is one of the greatest experiences of life. When somebody empathizes with you, you're going through a tough time and somebody walks in your shoes, somebody, you know, walks into your life. I mean, I think when my brother died, I felt alone. There were people around me, but I felt alone. But God has come into the world. He made an appearance on planet Earth in time and space. And if you look at the life of Jesus, you look at the compassion he had, and then you look at his extraordinary death, and then the resurrection. Why is there so much emphasis upon the resurrection? Well, again, I think the reason is because with careful reflection, the enemy is death. You know, if naturalism is true, there isn't a lot of hope and a lot of purpose. As we get a little further into the show here, I want to touch upon just an article that I read recently. This is from First Things. First Things is a Catholic magazine, but it is largely kind of an ecumenical magazine. There are Protestants and Eastern Orthodox authors who write in it. The founding editor was himself kind of an ecumenical Catholic. And I like to read it. I'm interested in Catholicism. I'm also interested in what the different branches of Christendom have in common. People who listen to this program will know of my interest in the branches of Christendom. But there was an interesting article here. I just want to quote a little bit of it. It has a title that gripped me. It's entitled Dying of Despair. Dying of Despair. The author, his name is Aaron Carity. It says he is associate professor of psychiatry, director of the medical ethics program at the University of California Irvine School of Medicine, so right down the freeway here in Southern California. It's an interesting article. It says Angus Deaton, a Princeton economist who won the Nobel Prize for his work on the intricacies of measuring human well-being, has been following what is now a national epidemic of suicide and depression. In a recent study, he found that since 1999, there have been an alarming national increase in deaths from drugs, alcohol abuse, and suicide, a trend that is especially pronounced among white Americans born since 1975. Deaton calls these, quote, deaths of despair, unquote. And of course, the article talks about, often the challenge of mental health and depression. Most people who commit suicide are deeply depressed. It talks about bipolar disorder and various issues. But the article goes deeper. It says this. It says, we now have a sizable body of medical research which suggests that prayer, religious faith, participation in religious community, and practices like cultivating gratitude, forgiveness, and other virtues can reduce the risk of depression, lower the risk of suicide, diminish drug abuse, and aid in recovery. There's a scholar at the University of Fresno, very academic school up north. He's a psychiatrist, but he also got a PhD in philosophy from Notre Dame. Unusual for a psychiatrist to also have a doctoral, an MD PhD, and the PhD is in philosophy. But this scholar said that, you know, a lot of times people deal with mental health challenges with prayer, with exercise, with changing kind of your mindset, your zeitgeist, your worldview. And one of the points that's made in this interesting First Things article is that a lot of times this is not merely a depression or a mental health challenge that leads to suicide. It's that people lose a sense of purpose in life. Mm. They have a real deep sense of of despair. Here's another quotation. Talk about hope. It says, hope cannot be delivered by a medical prescription. Yet we know it is essential for mental health. Hope allows us to live today, here, now, even as it orients us toward the future. Those who survived the Nazi concentration camps later recalled that death camp prisoners knew whenever a prisoner had abandoned the last vestiges of hope. The despair could be seen in his eyes and countenance, in the very way that he carried himself. In time, the prisoner developed a name for such people, the walking dead. Before long, the person who had lost hope would stop eating and drinking, would come down with a terminal infection, or would straggle and be shot. We cannot live without hope. Mm. And here's the last quotation, and I want to touch upon it. It says, contrary to popular myths about lemmings, suicide is uniquely human behavior. Man is the only animal that deliberately takes his own life. Suicide is an act that requires rational self-reflection and awareness of one's future, and it is influenced by one's philosophical outlook and social context. Now, here's how I want to tie all this together. And Joe, I know our time is just about up. I want to tie it together. I talked about wanting to look death in the eye. I wanted to understand death so that I could live life more robustly, more authentically. I've always wanted to be a courageous person. And the more I reflect, there's far too much weakness and cowardice in me. But what's interesting is it's hard to get away from that fear of death. That fear of death is always there. And I remember when the doctor just kind of came down and says, well, look, tomorrow we're going to look in your lung, and we're either probably going to find cancer or we're going to find infection. And I remember just a strong sense coming over me with my wife as we held hands and prayed, and I thought, I'm going to fight this. But you know what? There's one kind of person who doesn't fear death. It's the person who commits suicide. They have so much pain in life that they prefer death. Here's how that article in First Things closes. It says, a few years ago, a man in his 30s took his own life by jumping off the Golden Gate Bridge, as more than 1,500 other people have done since the bridge was built. This is, of course, up in San Francisco. Mm-hmm. I've been on that bridge, driving across it, not ready to jump off.
Now you have to pay.
Now you have to pay. It says, after his death, his psychiatrist went with the medical examiner to the man's apartment, where they found his diary. The last entry, written just hours before he died, said, quote, I'm going to walk to the bridge. If one person smiles at me on the way, I will not jump. Mm-hmm. And I find that, you know, I shared with my wife, I said, you know, I always wanted to be courageous like my dad. But what I found was these existential angst and fear of death, man, I think the only way you can develop the kind of virtue needed to face death is with the grace of God. I think that there really is what we call dying grace. But you know, what startles me, what baffles me, is that there are people who are so deeply hurting in life that they prefer death to the pain of life. Mm.
Now, there is also, of course, a group of people, atheists in particular, who claim that they don't fear death because they don't believe that there's anything beyond death.
Yeah.
I don't know what they think as death approaches, whether they really continue in that, you know, it's no problem, I'm not afraid sort of attitude. But
yeah, I certainly I try to avoid psychoanalyzing people, because I know when I look inside me, I see a lot of contradiction. Mm-hmm. I see hypocrisy. I see weakness, and I can only tell you that there was a time when I was sick where I was really afraid. Mm-hmm. I mean, I felt it. It hit me like a mm-hmm. load of bricks. You know, it didn't help to have brain lesions and lots of drugs pumping through you. And, you know, I've always felt like one of the things that has helped me in my life is I've always had a careful mind. I could rely on my mind, mm-hmm. even when things were difficult. But at that point, my brain was...
Wasn't functioning
very well. I was just trying to hold on.
We're not sure about it even now, but...
There are people who have doubts about me, even wow. outside of a hospital context. But I can tell you that it's one thing in theory. It's yeah, one it thing is. To be in a philosophy class and to say, well, you know, let's think about death. It's another thing to be on a battlefield like the Somme. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to be in a hospital where you have what you think is a terminal illness. Then it's no longer theory. Then it's a reality. But I want to close with what Jesus said. You know, Lazarus dies. Jesus kind of lollygagging. You know, the ladies, Lazarus' sisters, tell the Lord to come. You know, Lazarus is sick. Mm-hmm. Jesus kind of taking his time. Lazarus dies, and... you know, Mary and Martha, they're deeply grieving, you know, and yet they still say, Lord, all you have to do is say the word, you know. What confidence that they had, even in light of death. But, you know, Jesus tells them that, you know, anybody who believes in me, even if he dies, yet shall he live. And I think what we see in the gospel is, again, in light of my book, God Among Sages, I see things in Jesus I don't see in these other religious leaders. I don't see the capacity, the compassion, and the power to heal. You know, to even the winds and the waves obey him. Mm. But also his incredible death, you know, and death is something that is to be feared because Jesus feared it. Lord, Father, take this cup from me, but not my, your will be done. And yet Jesus is able to conquer that death. Dave, I don't know what all these atheists, my personal thought is I think atheism is a philosophy for young men who are healthy. Mm-hmm. And who are at a rebellious state of their life. I don't want to be too unkind to them. There are some thoughtful people out there who embrace atheism. Of course, you know, it's hard for me to get away from Romans 1. The people know mm-hmm. there's a God and they suppress the truth and unrighteousness. There are thoughtful atheists. I try to meet them on common ground, mm-hmm. talk with them about these. But Dave, I can tell you, I think the fear of death is great. And yet, a person must feel deep, deep sorrow in their heart, a lot of pain, Joe, that they would rather they overcome that intuitive, that existential fear of death and are willing to jump off of a bridge because of the pain that they have. And this young man says, I'm going to walk to the bridge, and if one person smiles at me, I won't jump. You know, we have the gospel, and according to this article, we have an epidemic of young people who commit suicide. And yeah, I know that a lot of it has to do with brain chemistry and, you know, maybe various mental health issues. But I also know that there are a lot of people depressed, and it's not just brain chemistry. They don't feel a sense of hope and purpose mm-hmm. and significance in life. They need what Søren Kierkegaard, the great Christian philosopher, said. You need a philosophy that will give you a reason to live and a reason to die. Mm-hmm. And for Kierkegaard, that was the gospel of Jesus Christ.
Amen.
All right. Thank you for that. Sometimes it starts by simply being polite while you're waiting in line, huh?
All yeah. Right.
Okay. Well, we will pick it up with part two, and you have... let us know before the podcast that there are stages of grief, so we'll get into that on the second podcast. Thanks, Ken. We'll look forward to hearing more of that. You have also written on this topic. We might suggest a Christian Endgame, Careful Thinking About the End Times, your small book on that topic. So pick that up if you don't have a copy of it, you can get that here at RTB. And be sure to check out Ken's blog, where he's always writing about topics like this and other topics as well. ReflectionsByKen.wordpress.com. For Ken Samples and Dave Rogstad, this is Joe Aguirre with a reminder that the goal of apologetics is not victory but truth. Thanks for listening, and join us for the next edition of Imago Dei.
We'd like to thank our monthly partners for making this broadcast possible. If you're not a monthly partner or would like information about becoming one, please go to reasons.org/monthly partners. Also, find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter, where you can join the conversation about the latest scientific discoveries, headlines, and their apologetic value.